loud. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we'll have your usual culinary conundrums, we'll have our technique of the week, and we decided to bring a scientist into the mixer today. A rock star scientist, yeah, who's fairly nifty on a lead guitar as well. I'm not sure what he knows about grub, but we'll find out. Professor Luke O'Neill will be joining us later on. I've actually never met him, obviously. I heard him every 15 minutes for the last 4 or 5 years whenever COVID was going on. He never left the airwaves. But I thoroughly enjoyed him, Gareth, so I'm looking forward to having chats with him.
Yeah, I've actually met him a couple of times. He was actually on the 6 o'clock show a couple of times when I was there. And I've also met him through the News Talk studio, because he's a regular slot on Pat Kenny. And as we know, I'm also do that quite regularly. So I met him over COVID. And I remember the last time I met him, he was like, we're kind of like ships in the night, because he used to do, well, he was on, during COVID, I think he was on 2 or 3 times a week giving updates. But I was obviously on every Friday giving my recipe. So I was on telling the nation about lemon pancakes and blueberry muffins, like really intelligent stuff. And he's on splitting atoms and blade and talking about all sorts of really intelligent stuff. So look, he's really...
We kept the country alive.
Exactly, she were there as well.
half the country couldn't feed themselves, sure. What was it? 25% of the population gets their calories from takeaways. That has to be the most incredible stat that took out of COVID.
I think that's changed, hasn't it?
Well, that's why takeaways all had to stay open, because the government realized that literally a quarter of the population, I think, are there, thereabouts, gets their calories from takeaways. Like, so many people still don't cook for themselves or can't cook for themselves. So I don't know what sort of nonsense you're spouting every Friday, but you're not getting through to anybody anyways, Dad, you know? You got to step it up a gear.
That's why they bring you in every so often, just to give the real recipes to keep us all in
tow. Just to give them something that they'll eat, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you can tell them all about the time you worked in America.
And I ran a marathon.
Yeah, ran a marathon, exactly. All right, looking forward to today. We're in good spirits, right? Let's go. So now we're going to go into our technique in the week. And I suppose it's worth saying that our my co-host, he's sitting in a truck overlooking the... Where are you, Gary? You're down in Wexford. You're on your Hollybops.
I'm down in Kelly's in Rosslare, yeah. And True to form, I haven't let the side down. I've jumped on and done the work. And I'm staring out at the ocean here, sitting in a truck, and the rain is pelting off the side of it. So I'm not missing an awful lot at the minute. Anyways, I can tell you that.
You picked a nice week to go away. It's played and rained every minute.
Actually, most days, I've only had like 1 or 2 days where it was raining. And actually, I ended up coming back to the K Club on Tuesday. Jeez, it's starting to sound like an awful holiday altogether, but I drove back up because the Pro-Am was in the K-Club, wanted to be there, but it rained that day. So to be honest, it's been sunshine for nearly every day I've been down here. But anyways, I'm here. My sound might be a little bit fuzzy, so don't be scowling me and sending me DMs and giving out. That's the reason, because Ed just can't get it right.
I've got one drafted out here already.
hanging me out to dry.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So our technique of the week this week is stewing. And it probably sounds like, oh yeah, what do I need to know about stewing? It's kind of a mundane type of thing. But really, stewing is a technique that, it's kind of a technique that really works to make secondary ingredients and cheaper cuts of meat especially turn into something that's probably better than a primary cut. So what do I mean by that? So if you're talking about a primary cut, you're talking about loins of lamb, lamb cutlets, beef fillets, sirloins, ribeyes. They're all kind of your prime cuts, and they can be cooked less and they can be like really tender without having to tenderize them. But then if you move into your secondary cuts, like your shoulders, your shanks, your bellies, your cheeks, things like that, they have to be cooked slower. And a few weeks ago we spoke about braising, but another way to braise or cook something slow is, of course, on the solid top or up on the stove, and it's stewing. So it's where you take, we'll use our old trusty stob pot again, or a cassolet pot, that nice big heavy pot that you have with a lid. And then you put your ingredients in there. And probably the most famous thing as an Irish person is, of course, the coddle. And Gary thought I was going to say stew there. I could see it in his eyes. And he's shaking his head. Yeah, but no, of course, an Irish stew or even a coddle are two good examples of a stew. But things like, you know, if you move into different parts of the world, curries are stewed. Tagines, if you move into Morocco and that part of the world, are all stewed. So it's where you take a secondary cut. So if we do an Irish stew, we'll do a classic one, an Irish stew. You take leg or shoulder of lamb, you blanch it in water, meaning you drop it into bring cold water up to the boil, give it a good skim, get rid of that first batch of water. This is a real classic way to
do. You know, Gareth, I'll jump in there. So many people don't know how important
it is
to blanch the meat and get rid of all that sort of scumminess. Is the wrong word, but
it's getting the impurities out of that first part of the lamb. And there's a very classic dish that you learn when you're in college called a blanket de veau. So it's a white veal stew, and it's that's what you do. You bring the lamb up to the boil. As soon as it comes up to the boil, give it a skim, get rid of that first lot of water. There'll be a lot of people listening, especially people's mothers or fathers that would have made a stew that wouldn't do that. And you don't have to do it, but it just gets rid of the impurities. And then putting fresh water or stock in on top of that, bring it back up to the boil, and then you'd add in your vegetables, your carrots, your celery, your turnip, your onions, and then a bouquet of garni, which is just a leek skin that you put some thyme and rosemary, and you wrap it up together in some bay leaf, and you pop it in. And then if you're putting barley or anything else like that in, and then you cook it low and slow, so the lid slightly ajar on the top of the pot, and you'd cook that for like two and a half hours until the meat is nice and tender. And then a half an hour before it's finished, you add in your potatoes, bring it back up to the boil, adjust the seasoning, and that's a really classic lamb stew. But Gary, maybe you have a different type of stew recipe you'd like to share.
Yeah, I suppose it's funny you said the blanket de veau there, and then I suppose the Irish stew then is a blanket d'agneau. Like, I was laughing to myself here. It's a long time since I heard those old college terminology.
I could see the fear in your eyes when I said it. It was actually my last exam. I made it from my exam. And you have to turn your carrots and turn your potatoes. And
yes,
it's a very classic way of doing things. But it done correctly is a really, really beautiful old school dish or technique. And you don't really see it in restaurants anymore unless you're traveling around maybe somewhere down the south of France or somewhere in the winter. You'd get a restaurant.
You know, a lot of those restaurants and bars in and around Temple Bars, like, because tourists coming over want to try a beef and Guinness stew or a blanket d'agneau, a traditional Irish stew. And you'll often see it in some on billboards or blackboards outside a lot of them bars in Temple Bar. I mean, I've never tried it. I think Parik's place, the Boxty House.
That's right.
He's a brilliant cook, an old school chef as well. And Parik, like, the Boxty House is actually the absolute best place to go if you want to get a nice bowl of Irish stew, because you can be sure it's made by a total pro in there as well. So if you haven't had one in a long time, roll down to the Boxty House. But I'm going to go, the minute you said coddle, Gareth, I said I would do studies. I don't know if you remember many, many weeks or months ago.
Yeah, you
even
mentioned it before, but I've forgotten.
Whenever you were talking about the coddle, I mentioned one that we would have made in Donegal called studies. And again, just like that, you'd basically be making a meatball with mince, okay? And like that, you would bring up some water to a boil or a simmer, and you would drop in the beef meatballs that you just make the way you just squeeze the meat together, really. If you want to have them light, you can add all or manipulate stuff, but for the stew, it ends up adding impurities to the stew. So it's literally the meatballs tightened up in your fist and then rolled, seasoned. Drop them in to, again, get rid of that first bit of impurity and sort of scumminess out of them, and then set it aside. Now in a separate pot, in your thicker pot, your stob or your cassolet, your Maripagas in, like, so again, it's carrot, onion, white of leek, and a little bit of celery, and then chunks of rooster potatoes or Morris Piper potatoes. Roosters are probably better because they're not as floury and they won't break down as much as the Morris Piper. So go with a rooster potato in chunks, everything kind of decent chunks, and then back in with the meatball that you've kind of boiled or blanched, and you're going to cover that in water again. And some pieces of potato, same trick as a lot of people would use with the coddle, have like a load of slightly smaller pieces of potato that are going to end up overcooking, and you want them to slightly overcook because they're going to create the starch that's going to actually thicken the broth. Okay, you want to have the bigger ones that are remaining whole, and you're going to just season that, add in your bokeh garni as well, and bring it up to a boil, and then leave it on a simmer, and leave it simmering. And look, mammy used, or granny used to leave it simmering on the edge of a stove, you know, for a good hour and a half, like really, really hot, until the potatoes and everything was cooked through. And then you give it the odd little stir with the back of a wooden spoon, and every now and again you'd catch a potato and you'd sort of nearly crush it against the back of the pot if it was too thin. You would keep sort of crushing the potato against the pot until you got the broth to a nice, decent sort of consistency. And that in Donegal is known as a pot of stewties.
Does it, so, does it, what did you call the Liverpool dish? Does this, and it sounds very like that. I can't remember what it's called. But in over in Liverpool, there's a stew like that that's made. It's very similar. And I think it's, they say the origins of it is because so many Irish people would have emigrated over to...
I'm getting Scouse.
Scouse, yeah. Bowl of Scouse, that's it. Scouse is like a similar type of thing. A bowl of Scouse is a... And it's mental to think that these, they're really very... they're peasant dishes, right? And they'd be, would have been cooked on an agar. If you go back even further, they would have been cooked on an open fire where they just sit and hung.
Well, it was a Stanley Range in Donegal. It wasn't a fucking agar, I can tell you that, or an agar.
Yeah,
it was at an old school Stanley Range. I got mine made on anyway. But I'll tell you what, they were absolutely beautiful. And the odd time, now my brother loved it white, like blanquette, like that. But you could also add, like, you know, you could mix like a tablespoon or teaspoon or two of Bisto.
All right,
and
yeah,
whisk that into it to thicken it a wee bit, and also to make it darker and more gravy. Like, you know what I mean? I kind of preferred it like that. But to be honest, and to some people, it might sound disgusting, like the boiled meatball or whatever it was. I gotta say, the flavor in this, it's right bang on an Irish stew, actually. Yeah. Obviously, it's beef mince as opposed to lamb. Lamb isn't for everyone. So if you're not mad about lamb, and lots of people aren't, it's a lovely way of having a stew with the meatball. It goes white, actually. Like, it's almost like a pork meatball, or it wouldn't be as white as a chicken meatball, but it certainly doesn't look like your traditional dark meatball that you would have in a ragu normally, you know what I mean? But it's a beautiful, beautiful dish. It's a lifetime since I made it, actually. I must give it a wee rattle at some point, you know.
Well, seeing as we're in the middle of July now, it's probably the perfect time to make a blade pot of stew, scouts, or whatever you want to call it.
As the rain hits me sideways, all I can think on is the stew gas.
Nice one. Okay, cool. So next up we have, we've already told you, Professor Luke O'Neill, who is a scientist, an author, a rock star, and any other, what else have you got there?
Not a chef.
But you like cooking, eh?
Oh, God, I do.
I'm
big into food, yeah.
We've had a lot of conversations, and I was talking to the lads before we come on. You and I, our paths were running side by side all through COVID, but for very different reasons.
You were
educating the world when they were living in fear, and I was just trying to get them to cook a little bit better.
Feed them, yeah. Food being very important for our mental health as well.
I used to do a monthly slot on PK, but at the start of COVID, it turned into a weekly slot.
Right.
I think you were on there a couple of times a week.
Yes.
You were doing all the updates.
At the peak, I was on 3-4 days a week, can you believe it?
Did you ever think your career was going to end up...
Well, it was. I wouldn't say it was stressful, but it was full on, let's put it that way. And as you may remember, people were frightened, and I saw it as a very important thing to keep the information flowing.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure loads of people have said this to you, but it was like everybody was hanging on your every word.
That was the pressure, to be honest.
Yeah, but like, there was a lot of information going around, and really, the information you were saying, and not just because I know you, was the stuff that I was really listening to, because most of the things you were saying, certainly in our household, was calming the nerves a little bit, because people like Gary and I our jobs, literally, the rugs were pulled from under us.
Yeah, stopped.
Yeah, it stopped.
Overnight, on it. Yeah,
and,
terrible.
And I'm not ashamed to say it. It took me a while to actually understand what was going on, but I got quite down about the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I remember being at home. I actually had to go and see the doctor over it. I just didn't know what was going on. And all it was the change of pace from being so busy and then also, you know, the worry around everything that was going on and the financial worries. I subsequently set up an online cookery program, which helped me get through that.
You adapted.
Yeah, and I think that's anybody that's in business or anybody that's that has that type of spirit will hopefully find ways. Yeah. But what you were doing was really, were you having to reskill or upgrade your knowledge?
People forgot. I was on my Pat since 2013, remember? So,
Then
at the height of it, someone sent in a message to Pat and said, Luke should be on the radio more. I've been on since 2013. I had to, the most important thing was to make sure I was saying accurate stuff, the information that a lot of work was needed for each slot to do with him. And it was moving the whole time. The whole thing was, the science kept changing, remember? And I think the main people were worried about was, will we get out of this? How long is this going to go on for? And I kept saying, we will. Science will crack this eventually. I didn't know how long it would take, mind you. But I knew we'd beat it. And my main message was to keep the ship steady for people, because there was so much fear, especially in people over 50, over 60, that age group, because they were seeing that they were at higher risk of severe consequences. And I realized that.
Putting the statistics up on the news every night.
That became ridiculous in my view in the end, didn't it? I don't know what that was about. I said, stop doing that. It's not very helpful. You know, it was good initially just to keep people focused on it. Mm. But as time went by, that became, and maybe the inquiry will reveal what we got wrong, you know, what we got right kind of thing.
One of my favourite stories is a neighbour of mine, and he listens to the pod, was we live in Swords, and he was going over to Malahide swimming, and it was a little bit outside the
2K or whatever it was, yeah.
And he was wearing a wetsuit, and he was stopped on his way back by the guards, and he forgot he had his wetsuit on.
Yeah.
And the copper says to him, where were you going? And he was like, oh, I was bringing bread over to me mother. And he was like, where do you live? He says, I live in Swords. And Gary's name is, you won't mind me mentioning his name. And every time I see him, I say, it's nice to see you not in a wetsuit. And the copper says to me, you bleed and go home, you scooper.
You see now.
So I think that's the other nice part.
That was nice.
Stories in COVID.
Yeah, very nice.
Everybody was saying, the guards were taking your car off and all this. Yeah. When they weren't, they were really just making sure that you understand.
That's
you know,
right.
I think there was a lot of people doing phenomenal work, yourself included.
And look, can I just ask you, like, was there ever a point during COVID, like, whenever maybe the information you knew or you were getting was, like, were you always conscious of trying to deliver it in a way that always gave a bit of hope, like, or was, like, well, was there any time where it was just like, God, we're really in a bad, bad spot here?
You have to be honest with people. You couldn't sugarcoat it too much either, you know, but I try to balance it. There might be bad news one day. I try and end it by saying, but we may do this to make that better. I always try to look at the positive side that we might come out of it, this kind of thing. But there was a dark days. I mean, when the vaccine business, as you may remember, 6 months in, it wasn't clear we'd get a vaccine. It could have taken years. And I knew if that was the case, this would have dragged on much longer than it did. And then we get to November of that first year, and then the first data comes out on the Pfizer vaccine. The relief, I actually burst into tears myself. Really? I'm not joking, because I knew now. I said, this is it. This is the start of us getting out of it. But before that, there was still uncertainties. But of course, I knew.
I remember that day. I mean, I wouldn't have known the day or the date of the month, but I definitely remember the feeling. Mm. You know what I mean?
Like,
I often wondered, I suppose, how people then that, you know, that were anti-vaxxers or weren't really into it. Like, I mean, I don't want to go down that road, like, but I was like, oh God, I just got such, no more than what Gareth was saying there about the worries he was having, I suppose, like, you know, myself, most of my mates, when there was no end of it in sight.
Yep.
Part of it, that first bit of lockdown, I think every chef in the country loved it. They reconnected with their families and partners and whatnot. Like, I mean, for the first time ever as an adult, anyways, I had time at home and it was amazing, but definitely that got old very quick, you know what I mean? Like, not everybody was lucky to be still getting paid, you know what I mean? Or getting paid something, but not when you're at the higher end of the pay scale in your career, to going from that to the next to nothing. Yeah. It was certainly worrying, you know, but the vaccine day was definitely one of the better days of it all.
That's
you
right.
know?
Yeah. I mean, I imagine, my struggle is you guys in your profession, musicians were badly hit. And hairdressers, actually, they were the three groups that often were contacting me, asking my advice, and are we going to get out of this? Because like, if I said to you guys, get this, there'll be a virus that'll shut down your business, you wouldn't have believed me. You wouldn't have believed me in 2019, would you? You know, or the whole world had to stop. I mean, it was startling.
The musicians, it took so long for them to come back.
Very much so.
They were probably last back in, weren't they?
I think they were last back in, yeah. And the publicans, famously. Remember, we had the longest pub closure of any country in Europe. Did you know that?
No.
And that was the advice. No. We knew this virus loves being inside a pub because you're shouting and roaring. You know?
It was an Irish virus.
There's no ventilation. You know, Irish pubs on a Friday night. And there were loads of cases of super spreader events in pubs because the doors are the windows are closed. People are shouting. And there was a study as well, Gary. I told this about Pat. They showed shouting expelled 10 times the level of virus than speaking. Right now, that meant if you're in an Irish pub and you're shouting your head off,
and that's the points are going in.
And so we had to keep the pubs closed for as long as we needed to, I guess. And it was a shame, but that was
I've done a corporate event out in Lansdowne. What's it called? Diviva. And I was asked to do this thing. It was basically like a Zoom event. It was a large corporate business, and there was people all around the world. And I was on teaching them how to make a cocktail. I'd done a rhubarb and something cocktail, and I taught them how to make brown bread. But the other people that were there was the Hot House Flowers were there, and they'd done a live performance. And I hadn't seen live music. I'd say it was about 18 months in, or maybe we were starting to come out a little bit. And Gráinne Seoga, she was the presenter that was bringing it all together. And I remember standing beside her and the Hot House Flowers playing, and it was an emotional experience. And I was like, it just goes to show, if you need to be shown how important the arts are.
Absolutely.
You know, as important as science.
Definitely. I mean, no question at all. Yeah.
Like, there was literally something that I don't think I'll ever experience anything
like. Yeah, I think a roller coaster, wasn't there, of emotions all through this two, 3 year period. Yeah. And I think we're just beginning to interpret it now, to be honest. I mean, of course, when it ended, I don't want to hear about that ever again, kind of thing.
Yeah. You know?
But now we're reflecting on it more and more. And there will be more of these kinds of stories coming out of it and things that happened and what people saw and how they survived it, really.
I mean, the other thing in my life that brings me that type of joy is food, right? And there's loads of times, and Gary and I, we're in our third series of this now, and we've given loads of examples of times where we've eaten a meal or we've discovered an ingredient or a recipe, or and there's only some things in my life that I think is like that, and music is one of them.
Yeah,
seeing a painting for the first time, I remember seeing the Mona Lisa for the first time with my wife, that I'll always remember. But is there things in science that do that for you?
Oh, there is. That's I'm a nerd. Right?
Yeah. You're one of the coolest nerds I know. Anyway,
well, honestly, guys. Every day I'm looking at in my business, there's new breakthroughs all the time. Science is always hopefully moving forward, and we're seeing new stuff and new insights and new discoveries all the time. And this morning I click in and look at, it's called PubMed, by the way. Now Pub stands for publication, not a bar.
Right.
So PubMed updates every few minutes. Two great new publications came out on arthritis. I work on rheumatoid arthritis.
Right.
Another breakthrough there. Little bits of information.
And
I go, wow.
People like you upload up to here. Is that how it works?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and it's a wonderful business to be in because we're always exchanging knowledge and you're learning from someone at the lab and some other. And I got out of conferences. And now that stopped for me. That, one of the big hits for me was like, I couldn't go to these conferences during the pandemic. Now they're back with a vengeance. And you meet people in the bar after, or over a meal, you know, or over a cup of coffee. That's when the chat happens, actually. And then another, that's very interesting. Tell me that again. You know? And then you might have a collaboration. So there's a real buzz about the scientific process.
And how much of your job is reading then?
Oh, a lot. All the time. Oh, yeah. There's all this stuff coming out the whole time, and you got to read an awful lot of stuff. Now, as you get more experienced, you can scan it, you know, and try to spot the key things. But the main way we get information is reading it or hearing someone speak at a conference. And again, that human element of turning in a room, it's like a musical performance in a way, you know. Mm.
Speaking about breakthroughs, then, like, I know, like, you sold your own company, like, you're in Trinity all the time.
Yeah.
But how long, or what was it that your company was doing? Like, have you got your own company within Trinity, or are you part of Trinity, or is that an invasive question?
No, that's a good question.
It is. Yeah, and what was it that your company was, and what did you sell?
Sure, yeah, that's a very important question. I mean, if you discover something interesting, most research happens in universities because we're paid to do research as well as teach. People often forget this, you know. And people say to me, "Oh, you got long summer holidays." So what are you talking about? I've got 15 people in my research team working full time. You know? So you make a discovery. If it's useful, and you might get a drug out of it, say, you want to either give it to a drug company, you can license it, and they'll pay the university, you know, the fee for that, or you form your own company. It's got a spin-out. And I managed to form a spin-out company in 2016. And what it was I work on inflammatory diseases. And there's loads of them, by the way. Arthritis is a good example. Psoriasis in your skin. Asthma, right? Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. They're all inflammatory. Right. Now, what that means is your own immune system, whose job it is to kill germs, will cause inflammation. If you have an infection in your skin, it'll get all sore. It's the same process, but now it's in your brain or in your gut in colitis or whatever. So I've worked on this for a long time. And we found a new anti-inflammatory, a new medicine that can stop inflammation. Really potent one, you know, really powerful. And in the end, then we had to sell it because it's very expensive to do clinical trials and stuff. And Roche, the big Swiss drug company, bought us. And they own it now, right? Now, they paid top dollar to our investors who'd been backing us, that they got a good return on this investment. And Trinity made loads of money as well. Because see, the university would be a shareholder because it came out of Trinity, you know.
Okay.
And now it's in patients. The thrill for me, Gary, is there's three trials running as we speak.
And what?
Wow.
That's going to have actual impact on.
If the trials work, the trouble is there's many a slip in this business and lots of failures.
Okay. Yeah, but you already got your beans anyway.
I got me divvy. Yeah. Not as much as the investors, sadly, but no, it's Parkinson's, asthma, and heart disease. And that's the thrill for me, in my regard, that these are now running as we speak. And we're waiting now for the day to know. I'll give you an idea, guys. There's a 90% failure rate in this business.
Well.
And it can fail because of a side effect. That's why you have to be so careful with new medicines and vaccines. They're very carefully tested, remember. Side effect can bring it down, or does it work? For some reason, your whole idea was based on stuff that was a bit spurious, you know. So we're waiting now for these trials.
So as part of your training or as part of your getting ready to do your job, rejection is probably more than...
I'd say it's most of it.
Most of it.
Often experiments are failing because your idea was crap or you can't do the experiment.
Did you have to learn how to deal with that at the
Absolutely.
Start?
And many people drop out. They don't like it, you know. Mm. And when you're a PhD, you do what's called a PhD. That's like your entry-level qualification to be a scientist. And during your PhD, you will fail a lot.
Right.
And you better get used to it. And of course, I have PhD students now who are in my lab. I tell them, keep going. My job is to say, you know, we'll get there in the end. But you're often failing. If we weren't failing, we'd make more progress more quickly. It's tough, you know. And sometimes ideas can be
more
wrong.
More learnings are in your failings, right, probably.
Well, that's right, exactly. That's the point, precisely. Yeah. And you learn
philosophically
from your mistakes.
And most things in life, right?
That's exactly
it's the
right.
The mistakes that really are the real
There's such a trial and error about it, really. You think we're very systematic, but you need a bit of luck as well. You need a bit of luck occasionally to get through.
What I always find fascinating is that there's new science to be found.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
with
all the magical minds in this world, that you're still discovering new things.
That's the thrill of it, really. Exactly. And when I began 35 years ago in immunology as my specialty, we probably have 100 times the amount of knowledge as we had then, can you imagine, about the immune system. Now, the beauty is you can deploy that now to treat diseases. That's the goal ultimately. But the amount of knowledge that's been accumulating, all these tens of thousands of scientists all over the world, you know, is wonderful to see all that knowledge build up. And then hopefully, as I say, it'll be useful for these diseases.
And is that why people are living longer? Or?
Absolutely. There's no question about that now, because I think you can expect now to live into your mid-80s, really. Mm. Most people can. If you go back 25, 30 years, 70s.
Yeah.
Back in the 30s, it was in your 50s people were dying. Yeah. And that's simply because of medical advances have allowed that to happen.
I see a huge amount. Sorry, Gary, go on.
Go on. Yeah. I was just going to say, like, what is the holy grail in modern medicine, Professor? Is it cancer, or how are they curing some cancers and not other cancers? Yeah. Or, when you can cure it at one stage, why can't they cure it at every stage? Or is that a stupid question?
No, it's not. They're very important.
So complex.
Well, there's great progress there. Let's start with that. And it's remarkable in the past, say, 15, 20 years. And what's happened is we've got the immune system to kill the tumor. We're training your very own body to smash up the tumor. It's called immunotherapy is the name of this, right? And that was always thought to be a good idea. Nobody could get it to work. Again, loads of failures. And it begins about 10 years ago. The first drug that can trigger the immune system to kill a tumor begins to work. Now, the trouble is, it's about 20% of people respond. We'd love it to get to 100. But now that we're on our way, there's great hope that we might get from 20, 30, 40% response. Now, when I say response, I mean a cure, remember. They're using the word cure more and more. But the trouble is, you can't predict who's going to respond. There's many unknowns here, but there's real progress happening there. The second one, Gary, is Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. because they're becoming an epidemic. As we live older, to older ages, the downside of it is these neurodegenerative diseases are coming through. And Parkinson's in particular, a lot of people have Parkinson's. I bet you probably know people. You know? Mm. So we need to make progress with those ones. And they're the ones we're going after. And my lab is doing Parkinson's, for example. So we're getting stuck in there. And again, there's new insights that hopefully will give rise to ways to... We may not cure it, but we'll slow it down. Mm. The goal is often to slow these things down.
I was at a wellness event a couple of weeks ago talking about, you know, a chef's approach to eating and food. And I see a trend, a worrying trend, that people are trying to find this magical diet that like gives you abs and makes you lean. And, you know, and the joy of eating is leaving. And I would worry about it even more with the 12 to mid 20 year olds. Yeah. Like and you see some of the nonsense that goes on social media.
Yeah.
And like, you know, don't eat fruit in the morning because it raises your blood sugars. And and I'm like going, what are you actually talking about? Like, you know, the message of five a day seems to be leaving us now.
And it's strange.
It's weird, like really
it's
weird.
It's a tough science to be in nutrition, by the way, because it's so hard to prove anything, really. Like from my point of view, the science behind some of this is a bit dubious because you can't do it properly. Like how do you test if you eat a pear before breakfast that's going to stop you having a heart attack or whatever it might be, kind of thing. You know, it's very hard to prove that, you know. So it's a strange one. But you're quite right. A big one for me always as an immunologist is stress is a massive negative on your immune system.
Right.
And if you're stressed, the immune system won't work as well. It can go off kilter. It can cause all kinds of problems. There's good evidence for this. So if a bit of what you fancy occasionally, if that's going to de-stress you, that can be as beneficial.
We had
the negatives, you know?
We had a chap on the podcast here a couple of weeks ago, John Belton, his name is. He's a very skilled and knowledgeable in his field of fitness. And he was talking about food hygiene, and it wasn't the HACCP side. Like he was talking about, you know, eating the right ingredients, that, you know, well-sourced ingredients, and staying away from stuff that's overly sprayed.
Yeah.
And is that kind of the way forward, would you say?
Well, it's hard. Ultra, as you both know, processed foods is the problem, really. You know, not avoid them, but be careful with the processing, because that will
whole
add ingredients.
Whole
food is the way to go, exactly. And there's good evidence that ultra processed foods damages your immune system as well, remember. So, in other words, get away from the over processing. It's obvious in a way. I saw a great line, Gareth, recently: to avoid inflammatory diseases, eat stuff that looks like food.
Right.
You know what I mean? If it doesn't look like real food, well, don't go near.
I just wish the messaging that was out in the world of, especially I have two teenagers and Gary's kids are a little bit younger than mine. I wish that was what they were getting forced down their phones.
Yeah.
You know, instead of saying, don't eat strawberries at 8 o'clock because it might make you feel like, go away, man. Stop.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, really, it's nonsense.
It is not.
Where, like, you're now, it's actual fact.
Oh, yeah, no question. You know, well, you see, we evolved 200,000 years ago on the plains of Africa.
Right.
And the lifestyle then might have been optimum.
Yeah.
And all that's happened is we take less exercise. In those days, you ran everywhere to catch the antelope or whatever. You gorged if you got food, because there was often times without food. A bit of caloric restriction is good, Gareth, as you know. If you eat less some days, that's proven to be beneficial. So the trick is to live like we did in the Stone Age. Yeah, intermittent fasting, yeah. Or maybe not so much that. Maybe don't have food for 12 hours, that kind of thing, you know, if you can.
And what is the benefit? What's the scientific benefit?
Yeah, that seems to reset your metabolism. And when you eat, then you won't lay down as much fat. The big risk is obesity, as you know. And of course, if you're laying down fat, that's a bad thing. If you're really hungry, you'll burn all the calories. You know, your body will extract as much as possible from that food. So they think caloric restriction is tied into that. It's better metabolism. And you're metabolizing the food in a healthy way, is the way to put it.
With that being said, then, so we've discussed, you know, what the science is. So what's a joyful meal experience for you? Where do you find joy in food?
People. I never like eating on my own, do you? I mean, I travel a lot.
Yeah, right.
And if I'm in a restaurant on my own, it's miserable. You know? You may have it being a 2-star Michelin restaurant on your own, you're miserable. So I think food is actually about sitting down with friends and family and enjoying the food together. Now, of course, if the food isn't great, it might take away from the experience. But to me, it's always a combination of people and whatever you're eating.
And growing up.
How do you find the food? Over the years, have you seen as a consumer the food get better in high-end restaurants in Ireland over the last, say, 10 or 15 years.
Are you kidding me, Gary? Loads of visitors come to me from America, collaborators, and they can't get over how good the food is in Ireland. I've got an Australian guy visiting at the moment, right? Him and his wife went down the country for a few days, and they were waxing lyrical about the food. It's a real change, isn't it, Gary? I mean, when I was a kid, it wasn't great. But now I think Ireland is competing globally, when you would both agree, I assume, in terms of the standards up and all that.
We would attribute a lot of that to Irish cuisine is really ingredient led cooking. And for a few years in the middle of my career, and I was going to say this to you, there was that molecular cuisine.
I remember that.
I remember it with
Blumenthal. Was that the guy's name?
Yeah, Heston Blumenthal. Now, he was doing it at the top end, right? But there was loads of people, like everything, it filters down.
Right.
And there was people that were doing things to food. They'd no understanding of what they were doing. There was no flavour behind what they were doing. And it was, they were chasing textures, really, is what was going on.
Right.
So they were using lecithin and, you know, agar-agar and all these different type of ingredients to stabilise ingredients to make them look a certain way. And at the time, I was, it would have been, maybe not a head chef, but certainly a sous chef. So I was in charge of what the food was, what was happening on the plates. And someone would make something and they'd be like, I've made this jelly, but you can pan fry it. And I'd be like, but why?
Why would you bother?
We want
you can charge more. There you go. You can probably charge a bit.
Yeah, well, it looks cool. I remember one chef.
And it tastes like an onion. Just cook a fucking onion.
Exactly, yeah. There was a German fellow working with us and he was consumed by it. Yeah. You know, but like, I mean, from a creativity point of view, it was cool because you're making things look like other things, right? Right. But I was like, come on, man, like it has to. But now Irish cooking, to what I see, I mean, and I'm involved, and Gary is as well with Eurotalk, that it's all about the ingredients and the less you do to them, probably the better they're going to be. Yeah. Exactly.
I think we're lucky in Ireland. The food is, well remember the beef is tremendous here because the cattle are grass fed, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And then all the vegetables. I mean, I think the quality anyway of the food is better because of the produce that's coming off the farms. Like America is a disaster. Whenever an American, in my opinion, in a restaurant in America, it's not great. And it's mainly because they're factory farming all the animals. There's cruelty. There's all kinds of negative about the agriculture sector in America.
And you know, there's a lot of science there, Professor. Like whenever, if you look at it, just there when you mentioned it's being fed grass, if you look at the life of the, whether it's the chicken or the life of a piece of fish or the life of a cow, and you know, what's going into it is what's really coming out of it, I suppose. And, lots of correlations there. Yeah. I mean, antibiotics and all sorts and what they're treating animals with in the States would be a big thing. Like, I mean, surely there's lots of things in your fields where people in America or other parts of the world are suffering from certain things that other parts of the world aren't. Would that all come back to diet or what do you look at there, or is it even a thing?
That's a great question. There's a mystery at the moment in my business. Autoimmune diseases have gone up. So, for example, lupus, which is a horrible autoimmune disease, Crohn's disease in your gut, they've doubled in incidence in the past 30, 40 years. Now, the big question is, why would that be? It can't be genetic because it's too fast. So it's got to be environmental. Now, what would be in the environment? It's pollutants must be one thing. But I've no doubt nutrition is a part of this, and obesity is a big risk factor here. And I guess you both would have discussed the microbiome and all the bugs in your gut. They're very important for your health. You know, if they go askew, that's going to cause problems as well.
So introduce some microbiomes, like drinking things like kefir, and like, is that a good idea?
There's a bit of evidence for that, I would say. You know, a bit of evidence, but a good balanced diet will maintain your microbiome. And in fact, fiber is the key ingredient for this. If you've got rich fiber in your diet, and it can be anything, you know, fiber is common. Yeah. That will keep the bugs in your gut healthy and keep them in the right sort of state to maintain your health, right? And in America, there's no doubt all those additives and processing, they're damaging the microbiome, you know, and they're making the bugs in your gut less healthy, and that translates into potentially Crohn's disease or some kind of, and your immune system can sense that noxious environment and now goes off kilter and begins attacking your own tissues. So it's a very important part of science that we're trying to understand why these diseases are going up, and there's no doubt that the quality of the food is a key part of this.
And is the goal, as a scientist, a magic little pill to fix all that?
Wouldn't that be wonderful, Gary? Which my company will sell, hopefully.
I wonder, or should we just be telling people to eat more veg?
You're not asking for much, Gary.
We're trying to make a very powerful drug here. Now, a good lifestyle, let's start with that.
Yeah,
let's
face exactly.
I mean, your best friend is your own immune system. always. If you can keep your own immune system in the right state, it'll fight disease, it'll fight a virus, it'll fight a bacteria, and won't attack your own body, right? Good nutrition, the dreaded things, exercise, good sleep is very important. Now, the trouble is, though, some people, even if they do that, they'll still get these diseases. They're the ones you want to treat and come up with some clever medicine that'll hopefully help.
It's so sad when you hear that. You hear somebody that's super fit and, you know, really takes care of themselves, yet they still...
Yeah.
You know, something happens to them.
And that can be genetic.
In your head, Colin.
And they're unlucky. They've been dealt the wrong hand of cards with their genes. And then maybe they get an infection and they don't know it. And that triggers the thing in some way. There's still mysteries as to what's going on here. But with the best will in the world, even a perfect lifestyle, some will still get cancer. Some will still get Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. And they're the ones that you ultimately want to treat.
That's what you're going after.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing.
The question that we always like to ask, or we like to try and find out about our guests, obviously we're chefs and our food is kind of a little, or our podcast is kind of a bit about food. It's what your food looked like when you were growing up.
Atrocious.
And how did it?
Well, no.
Is that what put you into the world of science?
My poor mother, meat and two veg. My mother was a classic Irish mother.
Right, good.
I never had rice, never had pasta growing up.
Gary, perfect household for you.
Were you like that, Gary? Honestly, but nobody in Ireland, I'm talking 1970s, nobody had this. My mother never saw pasta in her life. Spuds at every meal, you know.
Didn't you grow up at a proper home?
That's right.
Professor, that's what you did.
Didn't do me any harm, you know. And it wasn't processed food, like a bit of a lamb chop, a bit of potato, a few carrots, this kind of thing. So I'm sure it was quite healthy looking back on it.
Did she force liver and kidney on
she
you?
She did. Yeah. And tripe. My father was a big fan of things like tripe.
Really?
And pig's tripe. His generation loved that kind of food, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used to hate this guy. He'd get a lump of tripe and the little honey combs and vinegar. It's a stomach. He says, I love it. It's great. I didn't like eating tripe, you know, but he loved tripe. And pig's trotters, big in the boiling in a pot, this kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
But the transition for me happened when I was like 9 years of age and I bought a Vesta curry. Do you remember how that was called?
No.
Oh, the Vesta curry. It was a rehydrated curry. You added water to this stuff.
Right.
And it tasted like kind of like curry.
And okay. Had a few spices in it.
My taste buds went through the roof, having had, a bit of porridge that morning or whatever. So that was the start of my move into more exotic foods, you might say.
And did you go after that then? So when you're traveling, is food a big part of what?
I'll never forget. I went to London at the age of 18 one summer to work, and I went to a proper Indian restaurant.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. A place called Brick Lane in London.
Oh, yeah.
And I couldn't get over it. And I didn't like it initially, you know. Onion bhaji, what the hell is that? You know?
Delicious, that's
and
what.
Once I, and in, if I was to be asked my favourite, it'd be Indian food. And I think it must have been from those days, probably.
And have you been to India?
I have indeed. I've been to Delhi and it's very different there, by the way. It's not exactly like it is in the
UK. A lot of vegetarian food, right?
A lot of vegetarian, exactly. Yeah, but it's very good. When you go to a curry house in Birmingham or somewhere, it's a bit different than being in Delhi, I think. But those, for some reason, those flavours, I don't quite know what it was, but the curcumin.
Well, probably the fact that they were so exotic to you, right?
It must have been that, yeah. My taste buds were on fire, basically, in more ways than I got the spiciness as well for some reason that appealed to me. So, absolutely. If you get a good curry, you can't beat a good,
I agree with you.
In a good curry house. I was in London last week and went to a great one in Piccadilly Circus of all places. Lovely, yeah. It was really delicious food, yeah.
And what about cooking?
Oh God, yeah, I do a bit of cooking, fair bit, I must say. But that's a bit like a scientist, remember?
Right,
What you guys do is no different to me. Like when you add vinegar, you're pHing the cooking.
You're balancing,
You're adding in what you call a fat, we call it lipids. There's no difference. You know?
Right.
It's space and you stick it in an oven. In my lab, we often heat things up in an incubator. So, you know, and you're following a protocol you're following a recipe. We're following a protocol. So there's a lot of similarities. So when I put effort in and I bake a nice cake with the right ingredients and the right combination and it turns out nice, it's very satisfying when you manage to do that.
And the corner of the kitchen really that the most amount the science normally goes on is the pastry corner of it. Because if you do mess with the recipe, it's not going to work.
It's disaster, isn't it?
Work, yeah.
No, I buy the roll. I buy the instant, whatever it's called.
The roll. Yeah. No, for sure.
Makes it a bit easier.
And so what about your kids? I know your kids are in the one of them is in the world of science. Have you more than one?
Two boys.
Two, yeah. Both of them in the world of science.
They are.
So. Are they really?
I've infected them with the science germ. Stevie's a chemist, and he's doing stuff on very fancy stuff. What I call hydrogels, new materials. He's making, and then the younger one is in energy science. He's into the environmental thing, and they're both doing. One's doing a master's, and one's doing a PhD. Actually, so they avoided biology, which is my specialty, by the way. They're scientists, but they said to me, "Dad, your shadow's far too long for us to get into biology." You know?
Right.
But they are.
Have you taught them, Professor? Are they at Trinity or where?
One of them is. Well, the older one said, I'm getting out of here. He went to Edinburgh at 18, and that was probably wise, yeah. You know. The younger one stayed in Trinity, so he's still with us at the moment. So he stayed.
And they're into the music as well.
They like are.
Yourself. So you got to tell us about your band.
Oh,
before,
God, yeah.
When did that come about? Because I think I mentioned before off air that your son's in the band as
That's
well.
That's right, yeah.
But that's another trick they got off Daddy.
They did, yeah. We're the Metabolics. That's our name, the Metabolics. And it began in 2018. There was a conference in Dublin, a big immunology conference. Now, can you believe, Gareth, there were 1,000 immunologists in Dublin in 2018 and nobody gave them monkeys. You know? It changed during the pandemic.
Can't believe more than that is you're going to tell me a band was Bleeding Born.
It was in the RDS, big conference in the RDS. They asked me to put a band. I play music in my hobby, right. And I put a band together and we played at the big dinner, the big banquet. Every conference has a big party at the end.
Yeah.
And we played at that. And next thing, the Metabolics was born. And off we went, Gary, loads of gigs over the last few. And the pandemic stopped it, of course, for a while. But then we played a gig a couple of weeks ago in Berlin at another conference. We've got a name now for entertaining these nerds who are, you know, kicking back at the end of a conference.
And what does the mosh pit look like at one of these conferences that you boys bashing it out?
You wouldn't want to know. It's a little bit disappointing.
A bunch of neon lights inside a test tube and they wave it at you.
That's right. Well, they are scientists who are very serious. Our job is to get them dancing. That's the mission here.
Does it work?
Sometimes. It's enough. In Berlin, it was in a great beer hall, by the way. Great food, I must say. Fantastic, you know. And lots of German beer.
Sauerkraut and sausage.
Lots of sauerkraut. And half a chicken. And it was great food. And then they get a few beers, they relax a bit, you know, and then they start dancing. So our mission is to get people to enjoy themselves. That's the trick, really.
And do you gig around Ireland as well?
We did.
Keeping it to your own crew? Or?
No, we had a residency in a pub for a while. Now, this is before the pandemic in the Doggy Duck in Doggy, near where I live.
Yeah. Right.
We played in there maybe once a month kind of thing on a Friday night and just get in there and play a few songs and get people
dancing. The style?
Oh, we're like a wedding band is the best analogy. You name it.
You need a lot of points on
you. Stones, Beatles, you know. I've got a couple of great female singers, Rachel and Izzy. They do Adele. Have you ever heard of her? These newer bands. So we kind of cover many different genres.
Well, the name would suggest that you're another Rammstein or something.
That sounds a bit heavier. That's exactly right. Yeah. The name the Metabolics came from the word metabolism, which is a key thing when you metabolize nutrients. So and then we thought a little pun, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Someone said to me, "God, what do you call the Metabolics?" And I said, "Yeah, I've met many abolics."
And unfortunately, that will probably keep happening. Exactly. So one of the questions we like to ask to wrap the pod up is that if there was one meal, I think you've kind of answered it, but you might go into a bit more detail.
Yeah.
It's kind of the Last Supper. Look, what's the one thing that
I have answered? Yeah. Well, I'd start with a few nice papadoms, inevitably, and you can't beat a bit of chutney with a papadom. I love that. Onion bhaji would come in next as the starter, you know. And then maybe a nice lambuna is one of the things I like. Maybe that'll be the main course.
Proper food.
Pilau rice, of course. And then a Peshawari naan. You know these naans? I think what's in them?
Wow.
Is there almonds or coconut?
Yeah, they put almonds and coconut.
That'd be my sugar. And then the dessert is called kofti, as you may know. This ice creamy type thing.
Yeah.
It's a bit strange tasting to us used to HB ice cream. But that'd be the thing. And then, of course, washed down with Kingfisher beer.
That's me favorite.
Indian beer.
We need to go for an Indian together. It sounds like you can find your way around an Indian.
Oh, God,
the Indian tourist board sent you.
Oh, they have. Yeah, that's right. No conflict of interest here. I'm being paid by the Indian Empire.
Well, look, thanks very much for joining us, and I knew it was going to be a lot of fun and full of information. So
great, thanks for having me on, guys. Professor.
Thanks, Professor. Thank you.
Next up, we're going to jump across to our resident Ed Chef.
Oh, resident! I'm upgraded.
Exactly. He has culinary conundrums. What have we got?
Thanks to everyone for sending in their conundrums. Please do so continually at food@goaloudnow.com. Here we go. We're going down to Limerick first. Oh, apologies to Limerick. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Absolutely adore the pod. And as a result, I am trying to expand my culinary horizons. Since childhood, I have simply been absolutely rubbish at eating vegetables. Fair enough. I have recently, though, gotten into parsnips. What recipes, suggestions do you have, or cuisines it's good to have in? If you have any suggestions for use in Japanese or French cuisine, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you, Jamie in Limerick, parsnips.
Well, I know Gaz has spoke about cooking parsnips and parsnip juice loads of times on here. But Gaz, I know you have a lovely recipe with the honey roast them, don't you, I think?
Yeah, well, look, honey roast is really nice. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a different one, you know. So if you just get a large parsnip and top it, tail it, and then peel it, okay? And using then the same peeler, once you get it peeled, shave it into long strands, like until you don't peel or shave the very, very center core, but keep peeling it until all these long slivers of parsnips come off, okay? And set them aside in a bowl. And then you're going to sprinkle, I'll tell you what's really good to sprinkle on, Alexi, is a palm sugar. You can get palm sugar in any good health store around in the country. And look, if you don't have palm sugar, just use a regular caster sugar. But the palm sugar is better. Sprinkle it over your shaved ribbons of parsnip. Leave it for about 25 to 30 minutes, okay? Lift them off. Pat dry them. Pat dry them in kitchen paper. And then have a deep fat fryer or a pan with a little bit of depth of oil. Bring it up to about 170 degrees. Drop in the parsnips and let them fry. And they're going to fry beautiful and crisp. Lift them up, gently shake off the excess oil, and then drop them into a bowl with a little bit of kitchen paper, really gently, to let all the excess oil, just like you would with a portion of chips, okay? Let the excess oil roll off them. Sprinkle them with a little bit of sea salt, and then set them aside. While that's set aside, what I do, look, I have a dish like where I do this blackened monkfish with the coconut bell pepper curry. And I'll give you a really quick recipe if you want something like a little bit Asian, whatever. But just get a pot with a heavy base pot, turn it on, get it hot, tiny little bit of vegetable oil in with a little bit of onion, and then half a red pepper, a quarter of a green pepper, a quarter of a yellow pepper, and a tiny, tiny, maybe like half a stalk of celery diced up. Start to sweat that off without color, a little bit of salt, white pepper. When that softens itself down, add in maybe 1 or 2 teaspoons of red Thai curry paste, okay? Whisk it in or spoon it in, and then 1 400-gram tin of full-fat coconut milk, okay? And bring it to the boil and then turn it down to a simmer and let it sit and simmer for about 15 minutes. Blitz it with a little hand blender, okay? And then adjust the seasoning. Add in about a half a handful or a small little handful of fresh coriander. Give it one more blitz. And you should have a lovely sort of creamy, consistent coconut bell pepper curry sauce. And you can cook a little bit of like spiced salmon, spiced sea bass. I do this dish with monkfish where I just roll it in a little bit of blackened seasoning, pan fry it in vegetable oil. Then I add a couple of knobs of butter, lemon juice, base until it's cooked. Put it on a board. Let it sit for about 3 minutes and then slice it really thin. Get your plate, small ladle of your coconut bell pepper curry. Put your blackened monkfish slices on top of that. And then take a nice big handful of the parsnip crisps, sit them on top of the monkfish. And that is one of the nicest little fish dishes that you could ever eat. It might sound a wee bit, it might take you a while to go over and back that to hear it again, but it's a beautiful little dish and a lovely way of using parsnips as a garnish. And the flavor is very intense when they're fried and cooked that way too.
Jeez, well, I didn't know where you were going with that. But
that was incredible. Belter, huh? Wow.
Jesus. Well, come here,
lads, I'm some chef. I mean, let's just call a spade here.
Did you ever think of taking it up, Gary? Honestly.
I'm the real deal.
What did he say again about self-praise? Anyway, we'll move on.
Thank you, Jamie.
Just a little note for Jamie. If vegetables is a thing that you're struggling to get around and you like parsnips, you're so close to getting into everything else because parsnips have a bit of big flavour. But I would say try a celeriac because if you like parsnips, you're definitely going to like celeriac. It's a very similar type of vegetable. So I would say the next time you're out, grab one of them and then you're well on the road to vegetables there by the sounds of you.
And don't forget, Jamie, there's always turnips. Just sit down there. Yeah, you're sorry, one second now. We've got a professor in the house.
How's it going?
Hey, how are you?
Right, we're going to rattle on to the next question. Sandyford. Oh, I love this question. I fully realise I'm addressing two of the best chefs in the country and you are used to answering conundrums about haute cuisine. But I've always wanted to ask a top chef, what's your favourite greasy takeaway? Assuming you lower yourselves, of course. Deirdre Brown in Sandyford. Oh, I like this one.
Well, Deirdre Brown in Sandyford wants to expose our dirty little secrets here with our takeaways. And I think I've mentioned them before, but there's a Thai takeaway in Swords called Sanook. And the reason why I like it so much is it reminds me of a takeaway that I used to get when I lived in Sydney. And it's probably as close, I would say, from a takeaway point of view, as food that I ate when I was in Thailand. I mean, he has Thai chefs working down there, the guy that owns it, and it's very, very authentic Thai cuisine. So, look, I like a Chinese, like the next person, but really, if I'm going to be going out and getting myself a Thai meal and I don't want to cook it for
myself. And if you get a Chinese, what are you ordering?
I like chicken chow mein, or I like a chicken curry, or I like the black bean type of stuff. I like, you know, nothing really that I kind of hang me
on. Are you picking through it? Are you looking at the ingredients, like as a chef? I've always wanted to know this. Like, are you going, those vegetables are, they aren't blanched quite to my, or whatever, you know what I mean? This egg fried
well,
rice.
Well, one thing I can tell you is whenever you get vegetables in a Chinese restaurant, and Gareth, I'd be shocked if he doesn't think the same as me. If ever there was a group of dudes and girls that know how to cook vegetables, it's the Chinese, because it doesn't matter what Chinese in any part of the world I've ever had a dish. I love a ginger spring onion chicken myself. But if you ever get anything that's packed with vegetables, the color is always right. They're always al dente. It's almost always just bang on perfect as far as consistency goes, you know?
And not a turnip in the house or a parsnip to be seen.
Yeah, but listen, speaking of takeaways, right, I'd be shot if I didn't. I know, do you remember about a month or two ago, I mentioned the single sausage chicken curry tap in Steve's Cafe. Yeah.
That got some traction on your Instagram, I've seen.
Jesus Christ, man. It was all over the news in Donegal. Yeah, and it was a newspaper.
Exactly.
yeah. But Steve's Cafe on the hill in Remountain is just, since I was a kid, I mean, I don't eat takeaways really, but the odd time when I'm on a trip home, I'll always go into Steve's just whether it's nostalgia purposes or what, I don't know. But hands down, best takeaway in the country.
Good man.
In Remountain.
Thank you, Deirdre. Now, this one is from Emer in Ballina. A little involved, so I'm going to have to take my time with this. I want to make fried cheese sticks, specifically cheddar. I have access to decent quality shop brand cheddar, but I'm willing to pay more and drive further if I must to get a good result. YouTube videos all say to bathe the cheese in egg, then breadcrumbs, then egg, then crumbs. One suggests bathe, then flour before breading. Some suggest refrigerating or even freezing before breading, then fry them up. Some vids say low heat, some say high heat. My questions: is the chilling step important? If so, to freeze or to fridge? That is the question. What actual temperature should my oil be, and does the type of oil make a huge difference? Wow. Thank you so much in advance, Emer in Ballina. Cheese sticks.
Gary, you want me to take that one?
Yeah, you go first there, guys. Yeah.
Yeah. So really what she's talking about, which is smart, is the first part is called it. Remember we explained it last week when we were speaking about chicken schnitzel. It's a panne.
Okay.
Which basically just means flour, egg and breadcrumbs. And I suggested an ingredient last week called a panko, which is a Japanese breadcrumb. And I would strongly suggest spending your money on a packet of Japanese breadcrumbs if you really want to make these cheese sticks. Freezing the cheese, I don't think is necessary. Certainly not cutting it too thin. You want it that it's kind of the size of your baby finger. Mm. And then it's going to go, you don't need to season anything because obviously cheddar cheese is already a little bit salty. It's going to go flour, egg into the breadcrumbs, then back into the egg and then back into the breadcrumbs. And that's a double panne. What that's going to do is when you go and you eventually deep fry that, because you've put two layers of breadcrumbs, there's less chance of the cheese actually getting out. And that's what we're trying to do here. Yeah. So often if you're panning anything that's quite oozy, for the want of a better word, you double panne. And the best example of that is a croquetta, which obviously you get when you're in Spain. And a croqueta is just a really thick bechamel, so there's no real structure there. So that's a good time when you double pan out. Yeah, exactly. And then all you're going to do is leave them in the fridge till you're ready to fry them. You want to set your fryer or a little friture is what it's called, if you just do a homemade one on the top of your stove top, 180 degrees, and you're going to put them in till they're just golden. Don't overload the basket. And when they come out, then I would season them just a tiny little bit with salt just to get the breadcrumb seasoned. And that's it. That's simple to make.
And is cheddar the best cheese?
Cheddar's good because it has good structure. But if you want those stringy ones, that Gary's disagreeing with me, I think. But
oh, look at him. Look at him. His head shaking.
You can use a stiff mozzarella or whatever, not like a... Yeah. Not a buffalo or anything like that, but mozzarella is probably the classic one. And he's nodding now. He's like that little thing on the front of your car.
Go on, off you go, Gary.
Go on, Gary. We let you loose there. What are you going to say?
Yeah, no, actually, well, I suppose, like, it all depends what she's after, you know. Like, the one thing I would say is, though, at least you said to put the cheddar in the fridge, you know, because cheddar melts fierce quickly. So it all for to make a cheese stick with cheddar, she's going to have a fairly decently thick piece of cheddar and take it out of the fridge, you know what I mean? Like, otherwise, once she goes to pull it apart, it's literally just going to pour out like a liquid, you know what I mean? If she's used to seeing mozzarella sticks or cheese sticks, as you mentioned there, that's nearly always made with a type of mozzarella that's molded or whatever. And cheddar would be lovely, but it just has such a low melt point, you know what I mean? Like, so look, if she is going to do it, you mentioned 180 degrees, that'll be bang on. You definitely wouldn't want to fry it any lower because it would need to cook rapid quick on the outside, like, because it will melt quite quickly on the inside. But any of those ones where she sees, and anybody, I always find when they start talking about deep fat frying cheese, when they're on Instagram or here and there, they're looking at people breaking it with their hands and pulling it apart and getting that sort of little Instagram moment where they're pulling the strand apart. And the only cheese you're going to get that with is probably mozzarella. But another one that's obviously a bit more expensive that is absolutely gorgeous deep fat fried is brie. And the bigger the chunk, the better. You know, you don't want to have it in little thin pieces. Like, give yourself a fairly decent, maybe 2-inch squared chunk of brie. And again, with the panko, the only thing I'd say about the panko is I'd split the amount of panko that you have, put half of it through a food processor. Panko's quite coarse. And if you're going to fry cheese, you need to have like a pinhead breadcrumb to cover all the gaps. So what I do is I mix like the pinhead ones, like blend half of it, put it through the more coarse ones, and then put it through the pan twice. But look, I think we're both right, Gaz, you know?
The better the chunk, the better. I'm actually stealing that for myself. Anyway, now, thank you all so much for sending in your conundrums. Don't forget, food@goloudnow.com.
So, that's us for another week of Dishing It Out. And Professor Luke O'Neill, I've met him a couple of times. I mean, he has so much personality and so much knowledge. Really, really enjoyable conversation. And I didn't think he was going to tell us that his favourite food was curry, I have to be honest. But yeah, as I was saying to the two lads there, I think we need to jump on a flight and get over to the UK, go to Birmingham or into London, into one of those proper Indians. Or maybe we might just go here in Dublin and go and see Sunil Garia.
Yeah. I'll tell you, one thing that's really jumping up, I think we need to put do a mashup of everybody's death row meal or last supper or whatever we're calling it, because they're all going left the field. Was it Alexa last week where I didn't see that coming? Like, yeah, and that was Barry Murphy. The amount of different things that people are really into is incredible, isn't it?
And I think it's just really a nod to what's going on with the world of food. And what I always said, it brings me so much joy when I ask somebody about that. And their face lights up to tell us what their favourite thing is. Like, we had that wonderful moment, Ed, with you a few weeks ago where you told us about the fried egg.
The old soda and the boiled egg.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, yes. We spoke about it a little bit there, but like, it's when you hear music or where you see a piece of art or food is definitely intermingled into all that. So look, thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for all the messages and all the questions in. We really appreciate the support the pod is getting, and it's going from strength to strength, and we'll be back with season four. I think we've one more in the bag and then we'll have wrapped up, and we're going to take a little bit of a break for a few weeks. So if you have any new listeners there, please listen to the back catalogue and share where you can. And as Gaz always says, give us a shout on Instagram, on Gar Mullins or Gaza Chef, or give Ed a shout indeed. I mean, we're happy to take them and get them.
If you want.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, look, thanks a million, and we'll speak to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.